So, welcome for Computer Graphics. We are currently speaking about ray tracing, and last week you learned about the basics of ray tracing, about iRays that we shoot from the camera, and about secondary rays that we use to obtain indirect effects like shadows, reflections, and so forth. And at the core of all these methods is always the operation to cast a ray. Yeah? And this operation is pretty simple. Given a ray with a starting point and a direction, we want to find the first intersection of that ray with any seen object. Yeah? It's a geometrically rather simple operation, but it's also rather costly. At least if we do it naively, that means if we intersect our ray with all the objects in the scene, with all the triangles in the scene. Yeah, if we have 1 million triangles, then this means we have to intersect a single ray with 1 million triangles, and we have many rays, billions of rays that we need to generate such an image. It's not only the eye rays, but also all the secondary rays, and I also told you about methods where we have multiple iRays per pixel, and also for the secondary rays, the number can grow very quickly. So having 1,000 rays for a single pixel is not unusual. Yeah? That means if we have 2 million pixels on our screen, we would need 2 billion rays. And if for each of these 2 billion rays, we have to intersect with 1 million triangles, and if we do that naively, that becomes very, very costly. Yeah, so we have to look at how can we accelerate these ray computations. And in fact, there are two things we can look into. The first one is how can we, as fast as possible, compute the intersection between a single ray and a primitive, a triangle or a sphere or so. We were looking at that last week. And the other one, how can we reduce the number of tests? Yeah, how can we, for a single ray, to find the intersections, how can we test with only as few objects as possible and so reduce the number of intersection tests? And in fact, this is what we will speak about today. Yeah, how can we, for a given ray, how can we quickly determine which objects might or which triangles might be in the way of that ray and only check these much, hopefully much fewer triangles. Yeah, just again I already spoke about these numbers. If we make plain ray casting, that means for each, we have the outer loop is that for each of the NP pixels, or I think we used M in the last lecture, and we test each of these iRays against each of the N scene primitives, then we have two nested loops. And altogether, we have complexity of number of pixels, time number of objects. And as I said, this can be very, very, very big number. So we have to do that faster. And in the end, ideally, so testing a single ray with a scene, if we do it naively, it would be O of N. That means proportional to the number of objects in the scene. But the goal today will be to end up with algorithms that have a complexity of O of log N, like a search process. This is required to make ray tracing practical. Okay, and as I said, it's very important. About more than 90% of the computation time of ray tracers usually goes into these intersection tests. So we somehow have to accelerate that. And usually we do that by building up a data structure, acceleration data structure, that allows us to do that ray traversal faster. And this data structure needs to be built in the very beginning. So we take the entire scene, build a data structure, an acceleration data structure on top of this entire scene. And hopefully then we can cast our rays faster. And of course, building up the data structure alone will be a rather costly process. This process should not be too complicated, because Otherwise, if we have a process for building up our acceleration data structure that is O of n squared, we gain nothing, yeah, because then we have an O of n operation that is accelerated by something which is O of n squared. Yeah, so we need to have a pre-processing that also should be lightweight. But we will see the stuff we will do fulfills this, and we at certain parts we will look into how we can do that. And all of these acceleration structures essentially always build on one very simple concept, and that is that of bounding volumes. I was already speaking about bounding volumes, for instance, when we spoke about view-frustum culling. And the idea of a bounding volume is very simple. So let's assume we have an object. Yeah. Now, this object is not really complicated. Yeah. But let's say this is a complex object. Yeah. A few hundred thousand triangles, or maybe millions of triangles. And what we can do now is that we build a bounding volume, a very simple geometric object that surrounds or that completely contains our object. And now when we want to intersect that object with a ray, we can make a very simple first test, yeah, a fast reject, so to say. And that is, we, instead of intersecting the object with a ray, we intersect its bounding volume with a ray. And if the ray doesn't touch that bounding volume or doesn't intersect the bounding volume, we can skip the entire complex object inside. Yeah? If it doesn't hit the sphere, the ray, then it cannot hit the object inside. Yeah? And we, for all these rays that don't hit our object here, we have a very fast solution. And maybe you remember that for the sphere we learned this intersection test is very fast. Yeah, so we can very quickly prune objects that definitely won't contribute. And yeah, in fact, this is the basic idea. Now the question is it really, would it really make sense, or is it the best option only to put one bounding sphere around? Yeah, probably not. If we have a ray that intersects our sphere, yeah, what we could do is that we say, okay, now we decompose our object into smaller parts, and we generate a bounding volume for each of these smaller parts. Yeah? And then maybe we find out, okay, the ray cannot hit the right ear, but it hits the left ear, and then we only have to look at the triangles in the left ear and so forth. Yeah? So we can build an entire hierarchy of such bounding volumes. And essentially, this is what the lecture today will be about. How can we generate these hierarchies, such hierarchies, and how can we do the intersection tests quickly? So maybe here, a first way how we could define an algorithm that uses such bounding volumes. Here the idea is that we have a scene that has a number of objects. For each of these objects, we compute a single bounding volume. We don't have a hierarchy yet. Yeah? And now to intersect the scene with our ray, we intersect the ray with each of the bounding volumes. And only if the ray intersects that bounding volume, we intersect it with a content, yeah, with a more complicated object. In that case here, the bounding volume is a box. And in fact, we will see that despite spheres are very elegant to compute intersections with, in practice, we mostly use such boxes as bounding volumes. Yeah, so a typical bounding volume that we use is a box, and it's a special box in the sense that it's not arbitrarily rotated, but it's axis aligned. That means the axis or the edges of the box, the sides of the box, are parallel to the x, y, and z axis. And yeah, this makes the computation of the parameters of a bounding box very simple, because we just take the minimal and maximal x, y, and z values. So if we look at that in 2D, yeah, let's say we have x and y, and then we have an object that maybe looks like this. Yeah, we can very easily compute the bounding box by computing the minimal x the maximal x, the minimal y, and the maximal y. Yeah, so the bounding box is defined by six values, minimal x, minimal y, and minimal z, if we're in 3D, yeah, and maximal x, y, and z. So it's six values that define our bounding box. And maybe it's interesting, yeah, that's also another advantage of bounding boxes, because computing these bounds here is very simple, and for a sphere, it is not necessarily. Yeah, if you have an arbitrary object, in fact, it's a very interesting computational geometry problem to compute the smallest bounding sphere. And it's not obvious, yeah, how, I mean, if we have an arbitrary center given, then it's clear how we have to select the radius. But where is the optimal center for such a, gives us a sphere that is as small as possible and bounds the object. Yeah, that's an interesting problem, and in fact not very easy to achieve, in particular in 3D. But as I said, for now we will take axis-aligned bounding boxes, so things are much, much simpler. Okay, and then of course we do exactly the same as before. We compute a bounding box of our object, and then for a ray, if the ray misses the box, of course, we don't have to worry. If the ray hits the box, yeah, it still can be that it doesn't hit the object inside, so that would be kind of true false positive. Yeah, we still have an intersection with a box, but not with the object inside. Of course, we hope that if we intersect the box, then we also have an intersection with the object. So ideally, the bounding volume should be as tight as possible, yeah, so that we avoid these false positives and test all triangles inside with the result there's no intersection. Okay, so axis-aligned bounding boxes are very simple to represent. Yeah, as I said, we need these minimal and maximal intervals, and now we can describe them using a notion which is often called slabs. So a slab in this case is an interval in x, y, or z. And essentially, yeah, if we look at this stripe here, this is a slab in x direction. Yeah, it's a range in x direction going from some x min to some x max. And the box we are looking for is just the intersection of all these. Yeah, so we have our ray intersects this box here in the center. If there is a part of the ray that intersects all three slabs at the same time, yeah, this is essentially what we are looking for. So if we want to compute the intersection between a ray and such a axis-aligned bounding box, what we can do is the following. We take the ray and we compute the intersections with the three slabs independently. Yeah. So in that example, for that ray, the x slab is intersected here at T1 and at T2. Yeah. So these are the ray parameters for the intersection. And the slab 2 is intersected at T3 and T4. So essentially now we know in the interval from T1 to T2, we are inside slab 1, and from T3 to T4, we are inside slab 2. And if these two intervals overlap, then obviously we have an interval where we're in both. Yeah, and in 3D, it's the same, or almost the same. Then we have three intervals, and if these intervals overlap, then we have an intersection. This is what we are looking for. So here, a counterexample, this ray here intersects the x slab from T1 to T2, and the other slab from T3 to T4, and you see these two intervals don't overlap. Yeah. Okay, so we don't have an intersection. Yeah. How can we compute these intersections? That's very simple. We can simply use this well-known ray equation. And then if we describe our planes here using the normal plane equations, yeah, like n scalar product with x equals some constant, yeah, then we can compute the intersection or the ray parameter for the intersection. We already did that for the planes when we computed intersections with triangles. Yeah, that's exactly these formulas. And now for the two planes of a slab, the normals are the same, yeah, because these planes are parallel. So n is the same for both. It's just this parameter which is different. Yeah, dn and df. So tn and tf, these are the parameters for the near intersection and the far intersection. So the entry point and the exit point of the ray, in some sense. We will also see that in a minute. Yeah, so if we have this slab, this plane is defined using n and d, I will call it near. Yeah, and this is defined with n and d far. So since it's the same n, yeah, this scalar product can be reused. This d dot product with n is the same for both. And now, to make things even simpler, because these are axis aligned slabs, in that example, for instance, n is 1, 0, 0. And a scalar product with 1, 0, 0 just means take the first component. So n times d, or n scalar product with d, in that case, just is the x component of d. Yeah? So it's not a complicated operation. Yeah? This here just means if you compute the intersection with the x slab, just take the x component of the direction of the ray. Yeah? This is this part here. And the same for here. Yeah, this is just the x component of the starting point of the ray. And I think dn even is only the minimal and the maximal x. Yeah, so these formulas become very, very simple because we are axis aligned and so forth. Okay, and with that, now we can compute our intersections. Yeah, we get t1 and t2 for the x slab, and t3 and t4 for the slab in y direction, and in 3D we would have t5 and t6 in z. And now we only have to check whether these intervals overlap. And when they overlap, we have a part of the ray is in all slabs at the same time, so we do have an intersection. And here we can see that. Yeah, so for instance, for this ray, we have in this interval, we are in the x slab, here we are in the y slab, so here in the intersection, that's exactly this interval. Yeah, we are in the bounding box, and we can compute that interval by just taking for all the entry points, yeah, for these two entry points, we take the maximum, that's this here, and for the exit points, we take the minimum. Yeah, so maximum of these two is that one, and the minimum of these two is that one, and now we see there is still some interval left, yeah? So we do have an intersection, and for a counter example, I should also have drawn that here. If we take that example, so in that case we have, so this would be T Y minimum. This is T Y maximum. This is T X minimum. And this is T X maximum. So we take the maximum of the minima. So that's this one. And the minimum of the maxima, and that's this one. And what we get now is that the maximum is smaller than the minimum. Yeah. So the interval we get is sort of negative. Yeah. And this tells us there is no interval left. Yeah, so the intervals in that case would look like this. That would be the interval in x direction. That's the interval in y direction. Yeah, I mean, you immediately see that they don't overlap, but algorithmically we find that out by taking the maximum of the left interval bounds. Yeah, that's this one here. So the intersection now would go from here, and the minimum of the maxima to here. Yeah, so this is the start of the interval. The start of the overlapping interval, and this is the end. Yeah, and now because the end is before the start, the interval is empty. Yeah, so it's very simple. So if we summarize that, we compute the t values for the six t values for the six bounds of our bounding volume. And then from the entry point, so to say, we take the maximum, and for the exit points, the minimum, and then we see if there's an interval left, and if so, we have an intersection. Yeah, so it's a rather simple algorithm. In code, we can also write that down. So first of all, we need a representation for such an axis-aligned bounding box. Usually we store that by storing two points, the point with a minimal values and the point with a maximal value. So essentially, these are the two points that span the bounding box. So this would be min, and this would be max. Yeah? And the box is spawn by this minimum and maximal value. And if we have so, we can take this code here to compute an intersection. And this is already a little bit optimized or quite optimized. So what happens here is, first of all, that we compute the intersections with the three slabs in a loop, because maybe already after the first two slabs have been tested, we found out that there cannot be an intersection. Yeah, then we can simply skip the third slab. And then another thing we have to consider is what happens if we have a ray that is parallel to a slab. Yeah, if we have a ray like this, then we need a special consideration, because if this ray is outside the slab, we can immediately stop, yeah, because then we don't have an intersection at all. And if it's inside the slab, we can ignore that slab and somehow and only have to look at the other ones. Yeah? So we have to take care of that one. By the way, this also solves the maybe existing problem that we have to divide by zero here. This is exactly the case where this is zero. Yeah? And so this is the special case. Yeah. So if we are parallel, then we check whether we are outside. Yeah, whether our ray is outside the slab, and if so, we are done. And otherwise, yeah, we are inside. The entire ray now is inside, and we can continue with the next dimension. And otherwise, we compute T1 and T2. Yeah. So maybe there's one other special thing. So instead of dividing by di here, first the reciprocal of di is computed, and then it's always multiplied with a reciprocal. That's a little bit old-fashioned, yeah, because multiplication usually is, or at least on older architectures, is a little bit faster, or is faster than division, yeah. So, because we need this division multiple times, yeah, then first here the division happens, and then a multiplication. But that's a minor issue. Here you see the computation with the intersections. Yeah, that's very, very little, only a subtraction and a multiplication then. And then there's another issue which we ignored up to now. Of course, if our ray doesn't go or goes from left to right, it first sees the minimal bound and then the maximal bound. But if the ray goes from as a negative component in this direction, it first hits max and then min. Yeah. So if we compute these ray parameters, yeah, we have to swap them if T1 is less than T2 for that particular slab. That happens here. And then we compute the minimum with a current interval. And if the interval became empty, then we are done. And if the algorithm survives the loop, then we have an intersection and we can compute the intersection point and so forth, and we are done. Okay, yeah, not a complicated algorithm, and it's pretty fast. There are extensions. So for instance, people were also looking at adding additional slabs, so an axis-aligned bounding box is a rather bad bounding volume if we have some a long thin object which is not aligned with the axis, because in that case we get a bounding box that looks like this, and you see there's a lot of empty space. Yeah, so if a ray hits the bounding box, it's still rather likely that it doesn't hit the object inside. So what one could also try is that we do not only intersect slabs that are axis aligned like these, but we add additional slabs along the diagonal. Yeah, and in that case, that would add these slabs and these. I mean, these don't contribute, but definitely these, yeah, make our object much thinner. That also works. Yeah, we can easily add them to this algorithm. We just we need scalar products now, yeah, because this doesn't work anymore, or it's at least it's not so simple. But otherwise, the algorithm stays exactly the same. Yeah, we have to store more values, but the boxes are tighter. Okay, so we saw boxes, yeah, are easy to compute. First, to determine the bounding box of an object and the intersection with such a box is fast. And now we could define a first algorithm that looks like that. Yeah, we take a number of objects in our scene. For each of these objects, we compute a bounding box. And then if we intersect a ray, we first of all intersect the ray with the bounding boxes and then only look at those objects where the bounding box is hit. And of course, then quickly comes the idea, we could also do that hierarchically. Yeah, as I already said before, what we could do in that example, yeah, is that we say, okay, we make a bounding box around these two objects. Yeah, and if the ray hits that bounding box, yeah, we look at the content of that bounding box, and that bounding box now first contains other bounding boxes for that tree and the table. So we intersect with these smaller bounding boxes, and here we find out, okay, only the tree is hit, but not the table, only the tree bounding box is hit, but not the table. And of course, we can do that even further, yeah, and can generate a real hierarchy of such bounding boxes. And when we want to intersect, yeah, we have now a complete, we see that here. But of course, these hierarchies usually are much bigger. So we build a complete hierarchy with a single root node, yeah, of bounding boxes. So we have a root node that's a bounding box for the entire scene, yeah, that surrounds really all objects in our scene. And this root node has children, and these are other smaller bounding boxes. Yeah? And each of these children, again, contains bounding boxes and so forth. So we get an entire hierarchy. And the leaves of the hierarchy are the triangles in the scene, yeah, if we assume that we only have triangles. So we have this now we call a bounding volume hierarchy. And this is already the first acceleration structure that we will look into. And in fact, it's already currently probably most often used hierarchy for fast ray tracing. Yeah. The advantage, I mean, it adapts well to arbitrary geometries. That means, we will see maybe a contrast later on. It exactly has bounding boxes where the objects are. The memory consumption is sort of predictable because such a hierarchy usually looks like this. Ideally, it's a balanced tree. And in the end, we will have nodes that have a certain fixed number, for instance, let's say 5 triangles as leaves. And if we have such a hierarchy, and we know we have whatever, 12 million triangles, we can immediately predict how much memory do we need for these intermediate nodes. So we can, that's easily predictable. There are other data structures where this is not the case. We will also see that. Each geometric primitive occurs in exactly one leaf node. That's also a criterion that later on for another data structure won't be the case. Nodes can overlap in space. That we see here in this example, for instance, this node and this large node, so this node and this node in space, they overlap. This also has some implications, which we will see. And we can do the intersection test now recursively. That means if we have this bounding volume hierarchy here, for instance, and we want to intersect the ray, we look, does this ray intersect this node? So this is the large box containing the entire scene. And if we first check whether this ray intersects this node, usually this will happen. And if this is the case, we recurse to the first child. And then we check, is this node intersected? And if not, we can immediately skip the entire subtree and can immediately go to the next child and continue with that. And this is a depth traversal on our hierarchy, and this can be done very fast and very efficient. But one disadvantage, we need a stack for that. It's a disadvantage if we want to do all that on GPUs, because there a stack is it can be programmed, but it has disadvantages. Good. So that's the idea. Now the question is, how do we build such a hierarchy? And in fact, that's rather simple. And the idea is we start with a root node. We do the generation typically top down. That means we start with a large root node containing the entire scene. So we have our scene with things and tables and so forth. And we start with a root node that contains all the objects. And then we say, we continuously subdivide, so we build our hierarchy from top to bottom. We subdivide that node or nodes as long as they contain more triangles than a certain threshold. For instance, 10. Or in that example, it was 5. Because we have more than 10 triangles in that scene, now we somehow have to subdivide that into two halves, into a left and a right half. And this is now the interesting step. There are many heuristics how we can do that properly. We will see one in a minute. So let's say, in that case, we subdivide into these two clusters. And so now we have a left node and a right node. We compute a bounding box for the left half and one for the right half. And from there on, we continue. And we take all the triangles from here and sort them into here. So here now we have this blob here and the table here. And then we continue. Probably it will still be more than 10 triangles. So we again subdivide and so forth. Yeah, and so we get a structure like this here, and we have a bounding volume hierarchy. And that's this pre-processing step. Yeah, that happens once when we loaded our scene. Then we first of all once do that pre-processing step, that we generate this hierarchy. Yeah, and once we have this hierarchy, we can do our ray traversal much faster. Yeah, then we start shooting our rays. And each ray can take that hierarchy to faster get a result. Okay, so yeah, here again, as an algorithm, so we start the method build tree, yeah, first creates a root node containing all the triangles, and then we recursively call this method subdivide. And what subdivide does is that it stops further subdivision if the number of triangles is below a threshold, or for robustness reasons, maybe also if a maximum depth is reached, then we stop. Yeah?
A quick question. The subdivision, if you only have one object left with a bounding box, we subdivide and divide the object.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So if you mean object, you mean an entire triangle mesh. Yeah, then we subdivide that one. In fact, these algorithms usually, they don't know things like object, but we always assume that we start just with a set of triangles, independent of object. So typically, this is called a triangle soup. Yeah, so we So, okay. So at that point, yeah, you have to we don't think in objects anymore. We really only have single triangles. So to compute bounding boxes, yeah, now we have a set of triangles, and they don't need to be connected. It could also be something like this. Yeah, and then we can also compute a bounding box. Okay. Yeah? Exactly. That will be on the next slide. Yeah, and that's okay. So that's a very interesting point. I mean, as a human, we look at that, yeah. And we realize, yeah, that if we split like this, that's probably a good idea. Yeah? We cannot. Exactly. Yeah? So the interesting question is, yeah, how do we split into these two halves? Yeah? And in fact, that's algorithmically very complicated. Of course, it's NP hard and all, yeah, very complicated. And in fact, we shouldn't also spend too much time on that, because if building up our data structure becomes too expensive, yeah, you must imagine that hierarchy contains millions of objects. Yeah, so I mean, these are toy examples that we see on the slides, but your real scenes are very complicated. Yeah, millions of these objects. Okay, so I mean, that's the basic algorithm. Yeah. So, of course, at some point we have to stop recursion. And if we decide that we want to subdivide somehow, yeah, then we have to find the optimal split position. Yeah, or how do we separate to left and right? Yeah, or to the two children. In fact, we could also subdivide to more than two children, but usually two is taken. And okay, we will see that in a minute, and then we create the left and the right child node. Yeah, we sort all the triangles according to our split decision to left and right, and we continue subdivision with the left and right node. Yeah, so that's very typical recursive procedure. Yeah, but how can we now compute the optimal splitting between to left and right? And what is usually done is that we say, okay, we must find a plane, yeah, that splits everything on one side of the plane becomes the one child, and everything on the other side of the plane becomes the other child. Yeah, I mean, a plane, you could also try to define more complex shapes, yeah, but as I said, we don't have too much time, or it should be reasonable. And one typical way to do that is the following. What we say is that we take our box, so let's say this is our current bounding box, yeah, and then we look at the largest extent. So this is wider than tall, yeah. So we say, okay, we somehow will subdivide it with a plane, yeah, that goes in this direction. So maybe this plane, or this plane, or this plane, yeah. And now we spend some time to find out what is the optimal split position. So where do we position this plane best? Yeah. Another question is, yeah, what is best? Yeah. Of course, intuitively, probably we would say we split it in the middle. Yeah, because then we have two equally sized halves. But it could be that maybe there is much more geometry in here. And this is mostly empty, yeah? And there's only two triangles up here, yeah? That span this bounding box, yeah? Or like this, yeah? So probably it would make sense, yeah, to split somehow like this, yeah, so that as children we get this tiny bounding box and this, yeah, so that we have more compact things, yeah. If we split here, yeah, then we would again get the same problem, yeah, because now all these objects and these tiny one again generate a rather big bounding box with all that empty space here, yeah. So we somehow have to find a way to reduce this empty space, or to keep that as small as possible, or to get rid of it as fast as possible. And so, yeah, we have to somehow find a way to say that this is a cool splitting plane and this is not. Yeah? And to this we need a cost function. Yeah? We need a function that somehow measures how good a subdivision is. Yeah? And in fact, now this is the art of building up such bounding volume hierarchies. And it's definitely an unsolved, there are solutions for that, but it is unclear whether there are not better solutions around. And it would definitely be worth to more think about that, or many people still think about that. And the typical heuristic that is taken for that, or the typical cost function, is a simple heuristic, which is called the surface area heuristic, SAH. This is still very widely used. It, for some reason, turned out to be very, very useful. And the idea is the following. Let's assume we have two nested bounding boxes. So we have bounding box A. Yeah, that's our root node. And now we subdivide. Yeah, let's say, so we get the child box B. B is now a child box within A. Yeah, it's the bounding box of one half, determined by some criterion, of one half of A. Okay? And now, of course, it's interesting to think about, if a ray intersects A, how likely is it that it also intersects B? Yeah? So if we look at that example, that would mean if we build this tiny bounding box here, we would have a box that is very unlikely to be hit, which is an advantage, yeah, because then at least this branch, yeah, can be very quickly skipped. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we will see the final formula in the end. So let's say, yeah, we have this child box B and it's part of a larger box A. How likely, yeah, is it that B is hit, assuming that a ray hits A? And the heuristic now says this depends on the ratio of the surfaces of the surface area of the two boxes. So the surface area of B, of course, will always be smaller than the surface area of A, and the ratio between the two is the probability that such a ray also hits B. So if B has half the surface area of A, yeah, then the probability that it's also hit is 50%. That's heuristic. I mean, yeah, that's sort of understandable, yeah, because from the view of the ray sees the surfaces of the bounding boxes. Yeah, so if I look at that constellation, my bounding box number one maybe looks like this, yeah, and the smaller one looks like this. Okay, that's not real perspective, but I think you get the idea. Yeah, and then sort of for the ratio of this over this is the likelihood that you also hit that one. Yeah, so that's a little bit the idea behind that. Okay, so this is an assumption, yeah? And this is also why it's called surface area heuristic. And based on this assumption, we can make the following cost function. And this cost function just approximates the cost for ray traversal. Yeah? So let's assume we built our hierarchy, and now what cost appears if we intersect or if we have arrived at node A, so we know our ray intersects A, yeah, what costs appear now for ray traversal? And the costs are the following. So first of all, we have, so the cost depends on the cost for the two children, yeah? So the cost is the probability that we hit each child times the costs for that child, yeah? And the probability for a particular child we can compute with this formula. So if we have two children, then two children, left and right, L and R, yeah? Then the probability that the left child is hit is this here. That's the surface area of the left child over the surface area of the parent. And the probability that the right child is hit is this one, yeah? And these are the costs for traversing the left and the right child. And of course, yeah, at this point, we just split into left and right. We don't really know the costs of the new children, yeah? So we cannot decide it at that point yet, yeah? Because it depends on how we subdivide these, yeah? So somehow we need a value. So what they do is that they simply say the cost is proportional to the number of primitives in the left and in the right child. Yeah. So of course, in the end, it hopefully will be cheaper because we don't test all children primitives from left and right. Yeah. But probably, or maybe at that point, it's the best we can do. Yeah. And then we need some additional cost for computing the intersection with the surrounding bounding box and so on. Yeah, it's a kind of constant factor that appears for this particular box. But for finding the minimum, this doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's a heuristic. Yeah. And there are many things that can be criticized. Yeah. So for instance, is that ratio, does that really give us the probability? Yeah, and is this realistic that we say the cost depends linearly, or is just a constant, just depends on the number of primitives inside? But it's heuristic. Yeah, so it's only heuristic. And in fact, it turns out that with this heuristic, rather good hierarchies are generated. Yeah, it's often considered as the standard to generate such hierarchies, yeah? So, just to summarize, yeah, we take, here we have different objects, triangles, stuff like that. Yeah, we say the maximal extent is in this direction, yeah? And now we subdivide, or we try to subdivide with one of these planes, and to determine the position here, where we best split, yeah, we simply try out multiple possible planes, splitting planes. With these planes, we compute this heuristic. Yeah? So if we subdivide along this plane, what is the generated cost function here? And then we choose the one that generates the smallest costs. Yeah? And this is already rather costly. Because if you imagine, in particular in the beginning, yeah, here we have 1 million triangles. Yeah, and just for one splitting plane, we have to sort these 1 million triangles to left and right and compute the corresponding bounding boxes. Yeah, and then evaluate the heuristic. That's very simple, but only computing the bounding boxes, yeah, when we split into left and right is already rather costly. So, yeah, now there are different approaches. So one, for instance, is that we take all the vertices and take the corresponding x value as possible splitting planes, yeah, but that would mean, in that case, millions of possible splitting planes. Of course, that's too complicated. So what typically is done is that just on a constant, with a constant step size, we look at varying possible splitting planes, yeah, sort to left and right. That can also be done with some optimizations by pre-sorting the objects into these slabs here. And then we can quickly compute the bounding boxes and find maybe not the globally best, but a rather good splitting plane, yeah, to generate our hierarchy. So if you're interested on that, there's a link, yeah, here on a, that's a kind of classical paper, how such hierarchies can best be built, how these grid sizes have to be chosen and so forth. Yeah? Okay, good. Is that understandable up to now? Yeah. And of course, once we've split in this direction, yeah, we now have two children. And for these children, of course, we do that then recursively. So in that example, we find out, okay, now this box is taller in this direction than in this. So next we split in one of these directions. And here maybe we split in one of these directions. We always split along the longest axis. Yeah. Okay. Good. So that would be bounding volume hierarchies. Yeah. It's pretty well understood how to generate them. And they work nicely. And as I said, right now they are kind of the standard, but there's another alternative, which is also well examined. And these are so-called spatial hierarchies. And here the difference, here the approach is different. Here where in bounding volume hierarchies, we started with the objects, or we look at the objects and split the objects into the number or the set of objects into halves, right? For a spatial hierarchy, what we do is that we look at the space and subdivide the space and then look at which triangles lie in which space cell. And a very simple example would be such a uniform grid. So what we do here is that we take the entire scene, we compute the bounding box, and then we subdivide this bounding box into cells, into little cells. Yeah. So we place a grid on our bounding box here. And now for each of these grid cells, we determine which triangles are inside each cell. Yeah. So for each of these cells, we determine which triangles are in that cell. Okay, and when we now cast a ray, we determine which cells of our grid are touched by that ray, and then we intersect the ray with all the triangles in all the touched cells. Yeah? So in that example, the ray goes from here to here. So we start in this cell, it's empty, nothing needs to be done. This cell is empty. This cell is not empty, so we intersect the ray with all the triangles in that cell. And here we also found our first intersection point. Yeah? And if the ray would not hit, then we continue here, here, and here we have the next triangles, and then we again find an intersection. Yeah. So now here, the partitioning does not happen on object basis, yeah, but in space. So that's why it's called a spatial hierarchy. And this has advantages and disadvantages. A disadvantage here is that triangles can appear in multiple cells. Yeah, so it can happen that we have a cell and a triangle, yeah, that intersects multiple cells. So this cell contains a reference to this triangle, this cell, and this cell. Yeah, they all reference the same triangle because the triangle is in all of these. That cannot happen with bounding volume hierarchies, yeah, because the bounding volumes or the nodes are defined by their contained triangles. So every triangle is only in one node. Here it can be in multiple nodes. And we will see what the consequences are. An advantage is that that we achieve something like an order if we are looking order. Sorry, if we look for a first intersection point. Yeah, because if we look for the first intersection point with this algorithm, if in this cell we find one, yeah, we don't need to look at the following points. Yeah, because as soon as we have a point, yeah, we know we are not interested in those behind, and then probably we can skip all the cells behind. Yeah. This is not possible with bounding volume hierarchies, yeah, because, or at least it's more difficult, because here the nodes also overlap. Yeah, so even if we find here an intersection, yeah, with that triangle, we cannot stop. We also have to continue with that one because it might be that there's a triangle like this, yeah, that generates an intersection before, because these boxes can overlap. Here, these boxes don't overlap, so that means if we have an intersection within a cell, yeah, we can ignore the cells afterwards, yeah, because these intersections will definitely be behind. Yeah, so this allows us an earlier exit for our ray traversal. Okay, good. So for a uniform grid now, the algorithm is simple. Yeah, for each cell we store the intersecting triangles, and then for ray intersection test, yeah, we traverse the grid cells along the ray and check all the triangles inside the cells. And now one question might be, yeah, how can we traverse the cells along a ray? Yeah, and in fact that's line rasterization. Yeah, we already spoke about that problem, or a similar variant. If you look at finding all the cells that intersect the red line is very similar to rasterizing the ray. Yeah? And in fact, yeah, that's the typical or a fast way to enumerate all these cells is to use a variant of Brasenham, a variant because we are now in 3D. Yeah, so our line is three-dimensional. So we do not only need an update in Y, but also in Z, for instance. And there's another problem. We already spoke about that when we looked at Brasenham. In that case, for Brasenham, yeah, we said for every pixel or for every row in our pixel grid, we only compute one pixel. So as a result, this pixel here is not set, yeah, because the line more touches this one. So this one we ignore, but in our case now, we may not do so. Yeah, we also have to look at that cell because there could also be an intersection here. Yeah, so we need something like a conservative Brasenham, yeah, more, or a Brasenham that really delivers all the cells that are touched here. And yeah, this can be done by looking at the decider variable. Maybe you remember we also spoke about anti-aliasing, and essentially it's exactly the same that we can do here. Yeah, looking at the decider variable, we can not only see which pixel is closest, but also which other neighbor pixel should we also add, because it also can be touched. So that can be extended. But in fact, there's another method for that very special case that is probably the more elegant algorithm in that case. And this algorithm works as follows. So what is done here is that the vertical lines and the horizontal lines or slabs of the grid are first considered separately. So let's say we have this ray, and with this ray we want to intersect the grid, and these are the vertical lines of that grid. And now if we look at these distances from grid plane to grid plane, we see that these grid distances along the ray are always constant. Yeah? So along the ray, we know every delta Tx, we have one intersection. Yeah? So I know if I'm here, so every whatever 2.3 meters, I have a new intersection if I walk along the ray. Yeah? Always at a constant rate, new intersections appear. And of course, the same also for the Y slabs. Yeah, this distance is different, but we can pre-compute it. It only depends on the direction of the ray. So we can pre-compute these step sizes for x, y, and also in the set dimension. Yeah. Okay, and what we do now, so here we can see that again. We start our ray at some point, and what we do now is that we compute the first intersection of the ray with an X slab and the first intersection with a ray in the Y direction of a Y slab. So this is Tx and this is Ty. Yeah, so this is how far do I have to go until I first intersect an X slab, and Ty tells me how far do I have to go until I have an intersection with a next Y slab. And of course, we also do so for Tz. So this is a little bit different because it depends on where within the cell our starting position is. Yeah, but we can compute that quickly. It's very simple algebra. Yeah, it's like the bounding box test. It's exactly the same formulas. Okay, so we compute Tx, Ty, and Tz. And of course, now if we start our array here, the first cell we are looking at is the cell where our starting point is. Yeah, that can be quickly computed. And then we look at Tx, Ty, and Tz. Yeah, and we, of course, now the next interesting point is when do we have the next intersection? In that case, it's Tx. And if it's Tx, then we know, okay, we have to go to the neighbor cell in x direction. Yeah. So Tx now is the smallest next intersection point, or the first next intersection point. And because it's Tx, we go one further in x direction. And if it's Ty, then we simply go one further in y direction. And if we go in x direction, yeah, of course, Tx was the minimum, so we can update, yeah, when is the next intersection in x direction, and that's simply by adding this delta Tx to this Tx. Yeah, this tells us, okay, with this Tx, we have the next intersection. Yeah, and so in every step, yeah, we always have the t values, the ray parameters, where there's the next intersection. Yeah, we see which is the smallest. This tells us, do we have to go to the neighbor grid in x, y, or z direction? And then we update the corresponding tx simply by a simple addition. And that's all. So, this is essentially, again, what I've said. And this is the algorithm then in the end. Yeah? And it says, okay, traverse the grid for a starting point of the ray for a given direction. And then minimal and maximal ray parameter. So we look for the grid cell for the indices of the starting point. Then we compute the first intersections with the corresponding slabs, yeah, that's these Tx, Ty, Tz. We compute these delta values, yeah, how to update if we went to a neighbor, Yeah, and then we simply look, yeah, is tx the first parameter? Until we are towards the, or left the grid, or at the end of the ray. Yeah, then we look, is x the first parameter? That's if it's smaller than ty and smaller than tz, and then we know we have to go to y, x direction. So we increment the x direction, we intersect with this, with our current cell, because this is in a loop, yeah. Next, then we, this is a little bit stupid. Yeah, we could do that out, pull that out of the loop because the update is not yet done. I try to remember to update the code here. Yeah, but I hope the idea is clear. Yeah, we simply decide which cell should we consider next, and then we consider at that cell. And so we step through our volume and get all the cells along the ray. Yeah, again, very simple. The updates are very simple and very easy to implement. Okay. Good. There are two things essentially that we have to take care with this algorithm now, and in fact, that's true for all the spatial hierarchies we will look at, of also for the others that we will look at in the following. Yeah, not only for the uniform grid, and that is the following. So first of all, there's one advantage that disadvantage. And that is, if we have a very large triangle or large objects, and we have a relatively fine grid, or in general, if we have a triangle that covers multiple cells, yeah, then it can happen that a ray that goes through here, each cell contains a reference to this triangle. So with this ray, yeah, we test the very same triangle multiple times. Yeah, and now you might say, okay, that's a little bit stupid. Yeah, if we once found out that this ray doesn't intersect a triangle, it doesn't make sense to intersect the same triangle once again. Yeah, but it's essentially unavoidable. Yeah, it will happen. There will be triangles that span multiple cells, and so a ray, yeah, that intersects both of these cells will intersect both triangles. But it's rather simple to solve with a method that is called mailboxing. And here the idea is the following. To each ray, we assign an identifier. Yeah, that's a kind of running number. Yeah, so the first ray we cast gets number one, the next one gets number two, and so forth. Yeah, we just always, when you generate a new ray, we count up a counter, yeah, and store this counter with every ray. And whenever we intersect a triangle with a ray, yeah, we store that ray number with a triangle. Yeah, that's this mailbox. So we say every triangle we get a mailbox, yeah, and whenever we intersect the triangle with a ray, we store that ray index in the triangle. So if the ray comes to a neighboring cell, yeah, and wants to check the same triangle, it can see, oh, in the mailbox there's still my index. Yeah, I already tested this triangle, and can simply skip and go on. Yeah, that's mailboxing. That's a rather simple method. It works, but in practice, there will be a very simple problem. Usually, we won't do this ray casting in a single thread, but multi-threaded, because we need so much time for it. We will use parallel architectures to do that in parallel, yeah, and cast multiple rays at the same time. If you have an 8-core processor, for instance, yeah, we can cast 8 rays in parallel on a CPU. And if we do all that on a GPU, we have thousands of threads that run in parallel, yeah. And what now can happen, of course, is that one ray intersects with a triangle, writes its ID to the mailbox, and then comes another ray, also intersects the same triangle, overwrites the mailbox, and then the first comes again, yeah, and sees now, okay, there's a different ray ID in the mailbox and tests again. Yeah, so the more threads run in parallel, the worse this method will work. Yeah, and it will, fail then several times. I mean, it's not a problem in terms of rendering errors. It won't, yeah, it's, I mean, if a triangle is checked multiple times, there's no harm to it, except that it just takes long. Okay, so that's one thing. Yeah. Another issue is the following, and that's also in some sense related. So let's look at this example here. We have a cell and we have a triangle, the orange triangle, it intersects that cell. And our ray is in that cell. So if we want to find an intersection, yeah, it will test the orange triangle and it will find an intersection, but outside the cell. Yeah. So here now we test it, we test all the triangles and it finds this intersection here. And now you already see it here. Yeah, essentially, at this point, we may not stop. I told you that an advantage of these spatial data structures is as soon as we found an intersection, we can stop and don't need to look at further, at later cells, yeah, because we know then the intersections can only be behind and we don't simply don't care. But this is the counterexample, and the problem here is that we found an intersection that is outside our cell. Yeah? And here we find that intersection, but if we go to the next cell, we see, oh, there's another triangle that has an intersection that is even before. Yeah? So in that case, we found an intersection with one of the triangles, but we still have to go to the neighboring cell, yeah, and to be sure that there's not another intersection before. Okay, but that can also be organized, yeah. I mean, we find that critical case, yeah, because that intersection is outside our cell, yeah. So we should always consider following cells as long as the intersection or as long as the new cell is not behind the first found intersection yet. So that can be defined well. Okay, that's just two things that should be considered, yeah, when implementing something like this. And another thing, of course, these uniform grids are not the best way to go. If we look at that example here, we see a disadvantage of uniform grids is that there are many empty cells, yeah, and other cells, maybe these here, can be pretty crowded. Usually triangles in such a 3D scene are not evenly distributed so that we can expect the same number of triangles in every cell. Yeah, but they are clustered. There are regions where we have a very finely modeled object. There are many, many small triangles. And then there are other large regions where there's nothing. Yeah, so the distribution of triangles is very uneven. Yeah, and so such a uniform grid is probably not the best, but I mean, we can do exactly the same what we did for bounding volume hierarchies. We can also look at spatial hierarchies. And the oldest one, in some sense, yeah, or probably oldest one to do that are so-called octrees. And here the idea is the following. Yeah, it's similar to here. We first start with a bounding box for the entire scene. Yeah, and instead of subdividing into a uniform grid, we subdivide our large box into 8 subboxes, 8 smaller boxes, yeah, lower left to upper right. Yeah, so these 8 subboxes. And normal octrees also simply split at the middle. Yeah. So we simply subdivide our large space into, or our large box into 8 smaller boxes just by halving along each axis. Yeah, and then the root node, yeah, the large node always has 8 children. That's why it's called an octree. And so here we see such a result. Yeah, we subdivide our large scene. Of course, in 2D, the octree is a quad tree, yeah, with 4 children. We subdivide that one, and then we see, for instance, that this child is completely empty. Yeah, and if this is the case, then we don't need to subdivide. Yeah, that doesn't make sense. So we keep that large node, but here we have information. Yeah, or we have objects inside, so we recursively subdivide that one. Then we see lower left, upper right, there's still triangles contained. So we again subdivide these and so forth. Yeah, and you see the data structures, the cells become finer where there's a lot of geometry, and it's larger where we have empty space. Yeah, so this data structure sort of finds large regions of empty space. And if we now traverse array, yeah, we somehow have to find a method which in fact is not very simple. Yeah, so it's not as simple as for a grid to find all the cells along array, but of course it's doable. Then we will see, okay, here we have a large empty cell, so we can simply skip that and that, yeah, so we can advance quickly because there are most cells empty. And as soon as we get close to geometry, the cells get smaller, yeah, and we get slower, but we find all necessary intersections if necessary, yeah, and the same here. If we found out, okay, there's no intersection here, then we can make a large step here again, yeah, and then spend all the work where it's necessary. Okay, so this is the so-called octree. Yeah? It's again spatial. That means it can happen that there are triangles that cover multiple children. Yeah, in the worst case, there are triangles that are just at the midpoint. Yeah, that then have to be sorted into all 8 children. Okay, but it works. But as I, yeah, in practice, or in particular, if you do high parallel computations and so forth, this data structure turned out not to be the fastest possible option or the best option. And a better alternative are so-called KD trees. They are similar, but there are also important differences. And here the idea now is the following. Instead, if we have our large bounding box here, yeah, we don't subdivide that into 8 equally sized boxes, but instead we only subdivide it into 2 halves. And we again proceed like for the BVH, we look for the largest extent, yeah, and then subdivide along this axis. Yeah. And now we have exactly the same problem like here. We again have to decide where to position that splitting plane. I mean, the simplest variant would be always to go to the middle. Yeah, but we lose an important degree of freedom, and we can get much better hierarchies by choosing that splitting plane well. Yeah. And now let's say, okay, we decide to split here, and then we generate all nodes with all triangles in the left half into the one child, and those from the right half into the right child. And of course, there can be triangles that are on the splitting plane, and these we have to sort into both children. Yeah, for now, that's the major difference to bounding volume hierarchies like we get them here, right? Things get rather similar again. And here is an example, yeah, how that could look like. We have all these triangles, and of course, in that image, this nasty part here, yeah, is ignored, or it just doesn't appear. And we first split along this plane. Yeah, the left half we split along this, and then along this, and the right half we first split along in this direction, and this direction. And the result is here such a nicely balanced tree, yeah, a binary tree. And this is a so-called KD tree. Yeah, it means that the split axis varies from layer to layer, or from level to level in our hierarchy. That's called a KD tree. Okay. Yeah, so here again the explanation. Every node is subdivided in one dimension only, and the split plane can be chosen freely, so we can exactly use the heuristics that we also used here for the bounding volume case. Another thing, yeah, okay. The split dimensions changes over levels, and one advantage now, in contrast to bounding volume hierarchies, we will see that this data structure allows a very efficient traversal. Yeah, we will see that algorithm, probably not today, but then on Thursday, because of that simple way this hierarchy is generated, we can do a very, very efficient traversal. And it's a way that allows us to also implement that test, for instance, on GPUs. Yeah, so we don't have to do the computation on CPUs, but can also do it on a GPU very efficiently. And yeah, that's one big advantage of these KD trees, yeah, that the traversal or finding the cells along a ray becomes very simple in that case. Okay, it's a leaf storing tree. That means what we do here is that all, let's put it the other way around. If we look at what do we have to store for that tree, we will also see that we don't need much information. It's very little. For every internal node, yeah, we only have to remember where was that splitting plane. And in fact, yeah, for this, we just have to store a number 0, 1, or 2 that tells us the axis, yeah, x, y, or z, and then the position of the splitting plane. Yeah, so this plus a float. And yeah, this is very compact. That's all the information that we have to store per node. And of course, then pointers to the children. And yeah, so that's very little information that we will need. In contrast to here, for the bounding volumes, we usually store the x min, x max, and so on, which here is not made. And we will see then for the traversal why we do so and why this in the end is an advantage. And only in the leaves, yeah, only at the very bottom, yeah, at some point we store the triangle information. Yeah, only at the lowest level. That's what we see also here. Yeah, only here the triangle information is stored, and these here only contain the information about which axis is split and where is the split position. That's all the information that is stored in the internal nodes here. Okay, otherwise the generation is very similar to BVHs. We can use also the surface area heuristic. Yeah, we stop subdividing if only a certain threshold of triangles is in a node and so forth. Otherwise, things are very similar. And yeah, now the advantage is that the traversal is very, very simple and rather elegant. And I would say it's definitely too elegant to press it into 5 minutes. So I will describe that one on Thursday. And just to remind you again, on Thursday, there will be the last lecture, not only this year, but the last computer graphics lecture. Yeah. Okay, so if you don't want to miss the last lecture, then come on Thursday. It's not really the last lecture. Towards the end of the semester in February, probably in the last week, I will make one more and give a little bit hints on, hints is the wrong word. Yeah, show how these exams look like and what you have to consider for these exams and how they look like. And so just to prepare you for the exam. And the exam, I think the date is already fixed. Is that right? April something. Does somebody know the exact date? Okay, April 14th. Okay, so there's still quite a long way. So first of all, let's see you on Thursday. Thank you.